Infowars.com is tomorrow's news today.
Financial secret during the deep dive. We've got it up on the screen right now. That's right. 1,000-year mortgage. Make your great-great-grandkids help you buy that beautiful Miami home that you want.
Hey, this is the best deal since sliced bread.
That's right,
you
dude.
Can pass this on to your great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandkids, okay?
And that's amazing. Hey, isn't that backing America's future? And that's the argument they'd use to sell it to you. The continuation of the deep dive. Tim Tompkins, take it away.
Yes, okay. So I covered a lot of things. I'm just giving you guys each point. What's all these things are, all these factors are stacking on top of each other, contributing to why housing prices have continued to increase. We're seeing the picture. Now, another thing that we need to look at is the interest rates, especially what happened during COVID. Okay, so let's pull up the interest rates here. Here's what we got here. So COVID didn't create the housing prices, but it did make everything worse. If you look at it, we have these things called the golden handcuffs is what I call these, and
right,
what the industry's calling them. It's basically showing you on this chart that only 20% of people have over a 6% rate. A majority of people actually have a rate that they locked in during that 2021 to 2022 period where they have under a 3-4% rate. And then all of that combined together, you're looking at a majority, over 80%, have about under that 5-6% range. That creates a lock-in effect in which people don't want to leave a house,
right,
to go and get a new house at a 7% rate, which they are going back up, by
sure,
the way.
Sure.
So this lock-in effect creates another shortage within the supply chain. And,
right,
you know, props to you. Whoever was out there while, like, interest rates on the federal level were at 0% and you could go get that loan for 2%, I applaud you. I really applaud you because, you know, I got the 6.5%. And let me tell you something. As a young buck, I really wish I was just born. Maybe in maybe Rex, we should have just been trading or doing something in 2009.
We wish we were boomers, man. We wish we were boomers. And then we would be sitting on the beach with, you know, all the stacks of cash and whatever, right?
Yes. So now that everybody's locked into place and the rates are super high, they're not coming down, and over half of the population of homeowners are actually below 4%, it means that they're not giving up. So who's actually to blame? And this is usually where the story goes wrong, and this is something that I also fell privy to. And you probably heard this narrative. You were like, Wall Street,
right,
buying up all the homes. Private equity is buying up all the homes. Blackstone, institutional investors, everything, right? Now, as I was almost hesitant to cover this because I'm like, people are going to think I'm an agent being implanted for these corporations,
right,
to tell,
right,
you
to back BlackRock. Yeah,
yeah, back BlackRock. God, I wish I was getting a paycheck from them.
Right, right.
But, you know, no, I'm not. I would
we
never
talk
sell
about
my soul.
Reality here.
I would never sell my soul. But all I'm saying is you can take it or leave it. You can fact check me on everything that I'm about to tell you. They're not actually the ones driving up the prices. They're not part of the equation here. They're only a very small percentage. So let's actually do this fact check. Let's pull up number 9 and look at the actual fact check of institutional buyers.
You want me to read it?
Yeah, go ahead.
Fact check. Do private equity firms own 20% of single family homes? No. Large institutional investors, defined as those owning over 100 homes, which includes private equity firms, own 3% of the single-family rental stock nationwide, according to Bookings. The share is higher in some local markets in the 20 metropolitan statistical areas where these investors are most present. They own 12.4%, but they still own far less than 20% nationwide. The Urban Institute similarly finds they own just 3.8%.
Okay. So if we're breaking this down, the institutional buyers, the ones that we're talking about, BlackRock, Vanguard, all of
State
those
Street,
State
yeah.
Street— they're only buying less than 2% or less than 3% of the actual homes, which means they aren't statistically significant to be actually moving the market.
Well, let's read the second half of that article. Let's get that back up because I think that's touching on the point you want to make. Considering purchases rather than holdings, investors, those buying non-primary residences, bought nearly 27% of all homes sold in the first quarter of 2025. Mm-hmm.
It did go up. What they're looking at here in the first part is the entire supply. Then they kind of took the scope. They zoomed in. Okay, well, in this year, how many? And that is because investing in real estate has become popular, and there's a lot of people that stepped in the market calmed down. The market was on fire, by the way, from 2020 all the way through 2023. You couldn't get a house without going over asking price and going on these bid wars.
You had all that money floating around from the stimulus.
Yeah, you had all the money, people were ready to buy houses, and then that kind of dropped off, and that's when some investors started to step in and started to buy up the houses, which leading to that. So let's actually pull up number 10 here, because mom and pop landlords are actually the ones that are contributing to the biggest supply of investors, and mom and pops, they own about 80% of investor homes. Now let's look at this chart here. 80% is mom and pop. I'm considered a mom and pop. I have only like a couple of investment properties. I worked very hard.
Right.
But it wasn't something I was given. But you've got this situation here. That's the majority of people. Okay. And then you've got 14% is regional investors. Those are kind of like smaller conglomerate, not those big State Street, Vanguard, BlackRock people. They're like kind of people who buy in different areas, but they're still kind of mom and pop.
Right, right.
Okay. And then we've got institutional investors at about 3%, and you've got smaller national investors at about 3%. So the 80% is the thing to be focusing on here, because now we have to understand of that, let's pull up number 11, the percent of homes owned, because I want to compare the investors to people who are actually living within the house and are not considered investors. People who are just like you at home who have a house, maybe you don't have a house, but the average American, and we can compare the two and just see how much. So investors are only owning about 20% of all U.S. homes.
Okay.
Okay. This is the key distinction. That means 80% are people who are actually inhabiting the house and living out of it in the typical American dream, as you would call it.
Sure.
That breaks down the argument here where we look at, well, it's just the big companies and the corporations buying it. That's a lazy way of explaining it. And I used to take that position too. What is your thoughts?
Well, sure. And it's like you explained, that's kind of the default. And we hear about these companies and how much power, all the power really they have over our economy, and that they all basically own each other. Like BlackRock owns State Street. State Street owns BlackRock. Vanguard owns both. They both own Vanguard. That's how it works. And you see this shadow system, go, man, like, is this the reason for this? And you go, yes, lowest common denominator, Occam's razor, simplest explanation is usually correct. Sounds like they jacked up the housing market. But you look at it more as a systemic problem that's been impacted by inflation, the various crises that we've had, and ultimately the overregulation that's designed to force people out of business.
Rex, you're 100% right.
And that's why I do deep dive.
Everything comes down to a supply, demand, regulation, all of that getting priced into the market. Also, when we made a bunch of free money and there was more liquidity and people had money, that also contributed to the problem too.
I mean, take it for an example, the retail sector. I mean, you look at Target, you look at places like Nordstrom. I mean, during the slush fund period of 2021 to 2023, they had, at the end of it, when things started to fall off, I believe like $5 billion in inventory that they just couldn't move because they had bought so much because the demand was crazy, right? And it just fell off a cliff.
You're right. And if you would think that this is only happening in the United States, you are surely wrong. This is happening across the world. Let's go ahead and pull up number 12. You've got these situations happening in Canada, Australia, UK, Europe. All of these different places are experiencing the same thing that America is. And I want
to— Western problem.
It's not just a Western problem. This is what I want to highlight. Let's go ahead and roll this clip.
Price of a typical home divided by a typical household's yearly income. In a healthy market, that number sits around 3. But this year, something unprecedented happened. For the first time in the report's 21-year history, not a single market was considered affordable. While conditions vary, most of the 95 cities now fall into the seriously or severely unaffordable categories, meaning a typical home costs more than 4 to 5 times what a typical household earns. And in 12 of them, things have gotten so bad, they added a new label. impossibly unaffordable, where the median home costs more than 9 times the median income. At the top of this list is Hong Kong at 14.4 times income, and Sydney isn't far behind at 13.8. Then comes San Jose, Vancouver, and Los Angeles. And once you start looking beyond those cities, you realise the same pattern repeats across entire countries. Homes in Australia's average city are now near 10 times median income. Even smaller markets like Perth or Brisbane are now less affordable than New York. In Canada, affordability has been collapsing since the mid-2000s. Vancouver has ranked amongst the fourth least affordable cities on earth for 18 years straight, and Toronto isn't far behind. Greater London homes now sit at 9 times median income, while the UK average has crept to 5.6, which is roughly double what it was in the 1990s.
Okay, I think we're
good here. Even the United States, more known.
Okay, so, you know, it's very easy to get blackpilled about these things. This is also a solution-based show where we try to think about what are other countries doing as well as America to combat these, because people are starting to wake up and realize that these are issues, and housing affordability is a number one or two issue for a lot of people, right? So let's go ahead and play number 13 and look at some of the global solutions, things that people are doing specifically to combat this.
To stop this. Some countries are starting to try. New Zealand launched a plan called Going for Housing Growth in 2023, which forces major city councils to zone enough land for 30 years of housing demand. Their goal is simple: make land supply predictable so prices can't spiral out of control. In the US, cities like Minneapolis and states like California have begun loosening single-family zoning. That means duplexes and small apartment blocks can be built in neighbourhoods that once allowed only one house per lot. This opens up supply where people actually want to live. Singapore is taking a completely different approach. There, nearly 90% of households own their homes, thanks to a massive public housing program managed by the Housing and Development Board. The government buys land, builds at scale, and sells apartments directly to citizens at subsidised prices. So yes, this shows that if you treat housing as infrastructure, like roads or schools, you can achieve near universal ownership. Then there are countries tackling speculation instead of supply. Hong Kong and Wales both tax second homes heavily. In Wales, local councils can charge up to 300% council tax premium. Taiwan taxes properties sold within 2 years at up to 45%, discouraging fast flips and speculative buying. And in the Netherlands, some municipalities have banned investors from buying in certain neighbourhoods to keep homes for locals. The US is now exploring a similar idea with the End Hedge Fund Control of American Homes Act. This act would stop hedge funds and other big real estate firms from owning single-family homes altogether. So yes, to fix this crisis, we need more homes, but we also need to rethink who's buying them, where they're built, and what kind of economy they're fueling. Because at its core, it's the same old story: a tidal wave of money flowing into a handful of assets and drowning the middle and low-income classes in the process. And unless that imbalance changes, no amount of zoning reform or new construction will make homes truly affordable.
Okay, so you guys have seen it. I'm pretty much done with this deep dive. I just want to clarify something for the audience here. Again, this isn't me trying to create a narrative where I'm trying to push you in one particular direction. All I am trying to do is challenge your existing beliefs, just like I challenge my own existing beliefs. And that is the key to these deep dives here. Again,
yeah,
we always label as it could just be this one issue. And often I'm looking at a lot of issues that we're doing these with, and they're much more complex than we give credit to.
You say it's a key thing for the show for us to do the deep dive. I think it's a key thing for everybody to do this type of thing, you know? And like what we want to do, what you do such a good job of, Tim, is disseminating the information for people so that we can actually become enlightened and aware on these topics. And even if you go, hey, I understand the housing market. Hey, I understand the oil market. Hey, I understand World War II. I understand Vietnam. There's always something worth finding if you're going to take a second or a third or a fourth look, and we forget things over time. So what we do, hopefully, is generate a spark that lights a fire in you for more information. We hope you seek that out and compare and contrast our notes to yours, and it's about making ourselves better.
You guys can fact check me on everything that I covered today. I am completely open, and if I'm wrong about something, DM me, you send... I'll correct myself. You know, I have no problem admitting when I'm wrong, but I feel like I did a good job of focusing on the information, distilling it down, because I do spend a lot of time doing this research.
This is the key, and this is what's so amazing about being able to do the show with you guys. Me and Tim here in studio, we do Gray Area Thursday, Sunday, but we're here 5 days a week, basically doing the morning show now on the American Journal while it's around. The thing that's so amazing for us is this is a learning experience, right? We're getting better at finding things. We're getting better at presenting them. We're getting better at connecting with you. And that's ultimately what it's all about. So if you're happy with this, I really highly encourage you to go to therealalexjonesstore.com. That's therealalexjonesstore.com or thealexjonesstore.com. You can get the brand new Zeolite 72% off when you subscribe and save. That gets locked in. I think it's $16.99. It's a lot more, but hey, you get it locked in. If you get it now, you get the subscription offer. That's exactly what you want. Just $16.99 a month. You're locked in for life as long as you stay subscribed. After the sale ends, the price jumps back up to what I was saying earlier, to $24.99. You're going to want to try this incredible chelator, heavy metal, detoxification, all sorts of incredible stuff to research and look into about Zeolite. Get it today at thealexjonesstore.com. That's thealexjonesstore.com. I want to show clip 10. Okay, I want to show clip 10. I want to present it. We don't need to play the actual video. I just want to pause it on the general. And this general, I was over at my grandparents yesterday. They were watching Fox News. They had this guy on the screen. It pisses me off. Let's go ahead and show this guy. This is Jack Keane.
End this regime once and for all. And an enduring, stable Middle East, something we haven't seen in our lifetime,
really,
all right, pause is on the horizon.
All right. So if you're not noticing, if you're not watching right now, if you're listening to us in your car or at the gym or whatever you're doing, God bless you. Good morning. Rex Jones, Tim Tompkins, American Journal. He's got a Israeli American flag pin. Okay.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of that.
He doesn't have the American flag. He's not representing and backing America. He's representing and backing the American Israeli Empire Alliance regime, whatever you want to call it. This is unacceptable.
Yeah, this is the foreign entanglement that we talk about. You know, no country should have this much impact. Now,
imagine that was China. Imagine that was Russia.
If that was China, I would have a riot.
Mm-mm-mm. Yeah.
Here's the thing. I'm okay with us having relationships with the rest of the world,
sure,
cooperating, making good deals. You know, Israel has the same right to negotiate as China, as Russia, fair, those types of things, yeah, as long as we're getting fair and equal deals. But again, you dictating or influence our government to make a specific decision is another thing. The Qataris do the same things. The Saudis do the same things. I mean, look, the Qataris gave us a new Air Force One and said it wasn't a bribe. So these foreign entanglements are difficult situations, and the American people are looking at these.
Here's the problem. It's treated like our 51st state. Okay, that is the issue, because we could talk about the Qatari funding, which is massive, the Saudi funding, which is massive. Ultimately, we're not acting like Qatar or Saudi Arabia is our 51st state. They're not wearing Qatar or Saudi Arabia pendants.
Right. Yeah.
It's so wild to me, because we've talked about it numerous times, how you have these Gulf states. We'll talk about it with Suleiman coming up in the next hour. You have these Gulf states that are essentially, you know, dictatorships built on colonial line drawing.
Yes.
Right. And then that's the seat of the power. That's all the interest. But that one place in the region, even though all those other nations are allies and give us money, give us bribes, whatever, that one other nation, Israel, they wear the flag like it's the state that they're from. He's not wearing the state that he's from. He's wearing another country.
Yes.
Pretty crazy.
And just look, I'm kind of seeing why they're doing this. It's a signaling thing. There's people who are in
it's a signaling thing.
There are people in high positions of power who do control things behind the scenes. And I think it's that pushback, because you're seeing a lot of people speak out against these things that Israel did.
So they're signaling, I'm still on the team.
Yeah, it's signaling you're still on the team. Now, I don't agree with every single thing that comes out where people are criticizing certain aspects about all like Jewish people, and they're throwing everything under an umbrella. But we can be critical of people like Netanyahu who have a clearly a aggressive nature and a tone towards dictating how that region should be run.
Here's what's so evil about Zionism. Zionism attempts to attach a political ideology onto an ethnicity, onto an entire group of people. We got plenty of Jewish people that don't agree with what's being done by the state of Israel right now and the various genocides and wars that it started or engaged in, right? But they want to make that the definition. They want to make the IAEA definition of anti-Semitism the law of the land. It got struck down by Rand Paul, thank God, but it's true. They literally say you cannot criticize the state of Israel, because to do that is to be against the Jewish people. Well, hey, I'm sorry. I thought these were countries. Okay. I thought these were countries with laws and rules. And I thought we were allowed to criticize them, criticize China, criticize Russia. You're not being anti-Russia. You're not being anti-Chinese. You're being anti that country.
It is a lazy excuse to say, well, it's anti-Semitic. Just the same way, like, I would criticize somebody, like I criticize some of my own people and some black people who are like, well, that's just racist. I'm like, no, you can call out a specific group if they're doing something wrong is wrong. You don't get to hide under this veil of being a minority in some sort. Like the Israelis and the Jewish people are a minority in certain aspects, but that doesn't give you plausible deniability to say, well, everything is anti-Semitic,
right?
And you're being racist about this thing. But the
absolutely
thing that I'm looking at these situations and I'm like, okay, well, at what point do we address the elephant in the room and separate ourselves to where, you know, the founding fathers had a true, let me gather my thoughts here. The founding fathers,
roadmap.
They had a clear roadmap, and they talked specifically about separation of church and state for a particular reason, because religion and ideologies are tricky. Okay.
They didn't want a government run by religion. They didn't want us to have to fight these crusader style wars.
Yes. Crusader style wars is exactly the point that I'm getting at, because religion, and people can criticize me for this, is the best and worst thing to happen in humanity, okay? And I'll give you the explanation why. Okay? Bear with me for a second here. Religion is one of those things that you get spirituality, and it is super important for people to believe in something, especially Christians. You're supposed to gather under the faith of the Lord, be a good Christian. There are good values that are in there. The problem is when you have bad actors that use the religious ideology to push an agenda that is not within the actual context of what is being the spoken word.
Sure. I mean, the Pope came out and said, you know, God doesn't answer the prayers of people that have blood on their hands, right? So you have all these presidents and all these people, Netanyahu, prime ministers, constantly invoking God. It's the holy mission. You know what the holy mission is like a bloated corpse of a kid that's being eaten by maggots on the side of the street.
Yes.
Like that's what war is, okay? You're not a Navy SEAL. You're not a veteran. You can't talk about war. We've all seen the photos, okay? We've all seen the footage. We all know what war is. War is murder and death, and there's never a religious justification for it.
Yes.
In the modern world, that's what we stand against 100%. I want to go ahead and play this to close it out. Let's play clip number 8. All right, this is an American soldier a decade plus ago, I believe 12 to 13 years ago, 2012, talking about the wars and why they're fought, and look at when they pulled him off the air.
And we have here somebody who actually did just go vote for Ron Paul, a first-time caucus voter, Corporal Jesse Thorson, who is 28 years old, and you are active duty U.S. Army. Why did you vote for Ron Paul?
Well, I'm really excited about a lot of his ideas, especially when it comes to bringing the soldiers home. I've been serving for 10 years now, and all 10 years of those have been during wartime. I'd like to see a little peacetime Army, and I think he has the right idea.
Now, you have done 2 tours in Afghanistan. You told me you're going to go back for a third tour. I mean, if you can see your neck right there, what you have on your tattoo, 9/11, remember, and a picture of the Twin Towers. You know, some Republicans out there have been saying that Ron Paul would be very dangerous for this country because he wants to bring troops like you back from your posts from all over the world.
Well, I think it would be even more dangerous to start nitpicking wars with other countries. Someone like Iran, Israel is more than capable of.
Ooh, dangerous.
Sorry, we just lost our tech connection, unfortunately.
It's always a mistake. Oh, we got to cut it out. He didn't even say anything crazy. He's saying, hey, let them fight their own battles. If they want to go to war, let them fight their own wars. And what we're finding out in Lebanon with the 12 tanks destroyed and the tons of Israeli soldiers, IDF soldiers killed, you have the fathers, the mothers showing up to the Knesset saying, hey, I wanted my kid to come home.
Hey, I got a great idea. It's a new foreign exchange program.
Okay. All right.
The neocons and the politicians that want to be in war should trade their place with a soldier for a month.
Yes.
Right?
Lindsey Graham.
Let's put Lindsey Graham.
Yes. Instead of a bubble wand, give him an M16, put him in the trenches. Tank operator Lindsey Graham. We need to see it.
Yeah. You know, get him on the front lines. Let's put him in Afghanistan. Let's put him in Iraq. Get him suited up.
There are these boys with guns. I'm very scared now.
So that
you'd
way,
probably like it.
That way they know what it feels like to be one of our soldiers and what it feels like to be this guy who went through 2 tours and is like, I would like to see a little bit of peace, because those people live in very hard conditions and are under extreme amount of stress.
Sure. Well, you know, Lindsey Graham is the combat lawyer. You know, so he is a veteran. So that gives him the right to send people off to war and die. Man. And that's a key point to make. We're going to be right back. We have the great Suleiman joining us, the best live updates, the best information on the developing conflict. You don't want to miss it. You want to stay right with us here on the American Journal, murdering your morning, sticking the knife in and twisting it. We're killing that time, having a great time with you. We love you out there in cyberspace. We are in the void.
You just saw an ad for methylene blue. Tell people the short-term effect and then now the long-term effect.
Yeah, it gives you a good energy boost. I use it before I work out. So if I'm going to be doing kettlebell workouts, I do some methylene blue about a half hour before. Gives you mental focus. I don't crash afterwards. That's good stuff. I need some more.
How fast did it kick in?
About 15, 20 minutes. I take about a half hour before my workout.
And then you're saying you're almost out of the bottle. Was that 3 weeks ago, a month ago?
Something like that. Give me the liquid and the pills, too.
You're almost out of both?
Yeah, I'm almost out of both.
Oh, my goodness. Well, all right. I'll give you more. Right. For the audience, we can't give it to everybody. We need your support, theoxygenstore.com. For me personally, the first week I got on it, I actually started to hurt myself because the workouts were so crazy. My trainer goes, dude, what's going on? Like 3 days into it. I go, I don't know.
I like it better than doing like a five-hour energy shot because those will make you crash afterwards. This doesn't have the crash.
So you've had no crash.
Right.
If you'll just try it, you'll be hooked, and we can fund the operation. It's a win-win. Now's the time. Get the methylene blue, bare minimum, theoxygenstore.com.